This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the right of advice. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome everyone. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host Hussein Hinzano, and in today's lesson we're talking about the right of advice. Your friend is he who accompanies you, an everlasting wisdom practiced by sensible friends, men and women. Thus, the right of a friend over his friend is that he should advise him. Always remember that an advice is a show of love to the other person. And the other person, he definitely, so long as you call them your friend, they are owning the right of advice from you. Because every man needs advice from others, as he needs to prepare himself to accept advice also. For some people, they might not be very ready, you know, to accept advice from people. But later on, when they're not accepting the advice, they regret in life because they end up doing mistakes. All the human beings in life are created and they're doing mistakes every time. So having an advice from a friend, from someone you love, from someone you are together with, can help you reduce a huge amount of the mistakes that you do in your life. Man's knowledge and experiences are limited, and he has some stimulus in himself, which sometimes pushes him towards good. So sometimes also his knowledge can push him towards evil. And likewise. So there are some elements in man's life which encourage him to perform evil actions. Therefore, unless this particular person finds somebody to advise and guide them, many may fall into dangerous situations. Indeed, somebody who is not well versed in his life is liable to commit many mistakes in his practical life. Thus, he is in need of somebody to give him advices and knowledge. So sharing an advice is something that we need to look at, and it's a right between two relations. Whenever you have a friend, you're owing them an advice, and also them are owing you an advice. You're owing each other the right of advice.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host Hussein Hinzano, and we are talking about the right of advice. That two friends owe each other the right of advice. Whenever you have a friend, you need to advise them whenever you can. And them also, they need to advise you because we are not complete. We need each other. We need the advice of someone else in order for it to, you know, carry us along and make us make lesser mistakes in our lives. An advice can make you turn from a distorted person to a good personality, to a good leader in the world. Thus, everyone needs from somebody an advice. So a friend needs from anyone to give him an advice and knowledge. And this definitely may help them to choose the right channel or even the social, political and economic activities. And in choosing this, it causes them to come up with a good act in their life. So it is the right of your friend. It is the right of your friend over you to give him advices and to provide him with your experience in a particular thing, which will help him. It is either that you advise him to leave such a thing if there is danger in it, or to encourage him to act upon it if it is beneficial, or even to prove him with enough guidance and knowledge on that particular matter, so as to, you know, use in his action or an issue which he faced it in his life, like studies, marriage, type of work, or buying and selling of goods, or even participating in any social activity. However, because of its importance, giving an advice is sometimes incumbent upon us And no doubt Allah will punish us if we neglect to advise our fellow brothers on something that may harm them. And our great religion commands us to advise our friends and relatives because it is important. Thank you so much for listening to this show. Until next episode, inshallah, fi amanillah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Palestinian prisoners in different prisons of the Zionist regime have started protests against the continuous mistreatment by Israeli prison officials. Due to the insistence of the Israeli occupying regime on its cruel and vengeful measures with the aim of destroying the Palestinian organizational institutions, the Palestinian prisoners have started an indefinite hunger strike. Other groups of prisoners have assured to join this hunger strike in the coming days. Palestinian detainees have continuously resorted to open-ended hunger strikes in an attempt to express outrage at their detention. The Israeli regime's jail authorities keep Palestinian prisoners under terrible conditions without proper hygienic standards. Palestinian prisoners have also been subject to systematic torture, to harassment and repression. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at some of the world media for further details. Please stay with us. MondoWeiss.net wrote, on Tuesday, 6th of September, more than 400 Palestinian political prisoners in Israeli prisons entered their 13th consecutive day of punitive measures imposed on them by the Israel Prison Services, or IPS, including being locked in their prison cells and denied recreational yard time, all due to alleged affiliations with Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement. These repressive measures are also a response to prisoner protest and disobedience, which has reignited the battle of the Palestinian prisoner movement inside Israeli prisons. On 1st of September, almost 10 days after launching a collective civil disobedience movement in Israeli prisons, Palestinian political detainees were planning on going on a collective hunger strike in the light of these punitive and retaliatory measures. Just the day before, on 31st of August, Khalil Awadeh ended his hunger strike of 182 days, protesting his illegal imprisonment by Israeli authorities without charge and without trial. Khalil Awadeh is expected to be released on 2nd of October of this year, following his hunger strike's victory. Over 7,000 Palestinians are documented to be imprisoned by Israel including 32 Palestinian women and 175 Palestinian children and minors. Many Palestinian detainees are either arrested by the military in overnight raids that collectively terrorize entire neighborhoods or entire villages and towns, or are arrested at military checkpoints, which are guarded by heavily armed Israeli soldiers. Palestinian political detainees are regularly exposed to systematic mechanisms of abuse, mistreatment, and torture. Palestinian political detainees have been warning against the abuses practiced by the Israeli prison service ever since the Gilboa prison break of September 2021. Palestinian political detainees recognize that Israeli practices against them continue to escalate and intensify. In the light of these conditions, they have reoriented towards a new strategy of unity across political factions. The anti-war website elaborated more about the story, saying, according to the Palestinian Commission on Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, around 1 million Palestinians were imprisoned between 1967 and 2021. Currently, hundreds of Palestinian administrative detainees are held in Israeli prisons, an act that violates international law on various counts. Holding prisoners without trial and without due process and transferring prisoners to enemy territories, the latter being a stark violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention of 1949. Of course, respecting international law has never been Israel's strongest suit. In fact, the Israeli regime continues to deliberately ignore international law in numerous aspects of its illegal military occupation of Palestine, rationalizing such actions on security grounds. Palestinians are also doing what they do best, resist under the harshest of conditions, and by every means available to them. Tellingly, the strongest of such resistance takes place inside prison walls, by gaunt-looking and often dying Palestinian hunger strikers. This latest battle has become known among prisoners under the slogan of Unity in Confronting the Jailer, and is being run by a higher emergency committee, which is notably different from how past campaigns have operated, in that they were coordinated through factional heads. According to a spokesperson of the Palestinian Prisoners' Society, the most prominent decision to emerge from the emergency committee was the announcement that 1,000 Palestinian detainees would go on hunger strike. This was a measure of last resort, a strategy of pressuring the Israeli prison service to heed Palestinian demands. The Palestinian Wafa news agency had this to say. The Israeli colonial regime continues to hold Palestinians from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip in military prisons after being tried in military courts. Palestinians from the city of Al-Quds and those with Israeli citizenship face discriminatory treatment in Israeli civil courts, which criminalize them because they are Palestinians, and they're considered demographic threats and threats to Israel's national security. Most Palestinian prisoners, including minors and children, are arrested, detained, and illegally transferred across occupied territory into Israeli prisons, a violation of international law and the Geneva Conventions. Prisoners are often isolated from the outside world by the Israeli Prison Service, the IPS, by denying family visitation, limiting access to educational materials and television, and sometimes illegally putting them in solitary confinement. Moreover, human rights experts, international medical staff, and other officials are prevented from visiting these Palestinian prisoners, effectively imposing a humanitarian and a media blackout In the Israeli prisons, many prisoners are sentenced based on coerced confessions, which are obtained by Israeli interrogators through systematic use of physical and psychological torture, including the use of violence, the use of threats, intimidation, stress positions, sleep deprivation, being put in extremely cold or extremely hot conditions, and blackmail. However, even without confessions or substantiated evidence, Israeli military courts can still arbitrarily hold Palestinians without trial and without a charge, under the provisions of so-called administrative detention. Palestinian detainees are often placed under conditions that leave them with psychological scars, not only making it difficult to endure the prison, but also making reintegration into their communities post-release even more complicated. The heaviest impact is on Palestinian children, who can be treated with a criminality that violates their rights as children. For this reason, Palestinian political detainees continue to battle Israeli colonialism and apartheid from inside their prison cells. Strategies like hunger strikes are used as a last resort to push for negotiations with the Israeli prison service for better living conditions. Often these are bare minimum demands, such as access to family calls, to yard time, and entry of goods.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Ata, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion, we have very special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Nur Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Okay, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, for today's discussion, we have another interesting topic and question, and that is the reward for paying visit or ziyara to the tomb of Imam al-Riza alayhi salam or Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And it, according to some documents and references, it is equal, I mean, the reward of paying visit to Imam al-Riza or Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is equal to 1 million pilgrimages or Hajj pilgrimage. How is it possible that paying visit to the tomb of Imam will be considered as a reward of, for example, paying to the house of God, to the Kaaba, and to the Hajj pilgrimage? How is it possible?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know that in different narrations, we have the reward for the visitation of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam and for Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam. It has been said, according to a couple of narrations, it is, more than 1,000 pilgrimage to the Mecca, Hajj. And in some other narrations, 1 million times reward of the pilgrimage of Mecca and the going to Hajj. It actually has been specified for those people who go for the visitation of Imam al-Hussein and Imam al-Ridha alayhi salatu wassalam. Not only this visitation of these infallible Ahlul Bayt, but we have other recommended action has been, the reward of which has been multiplied to maybe more than 1,000 times or even more than 1,000 times. The very quick reply to this question is that the meaning of these kind of narrations is actually wanted to attract the people, attract the attention of people for going to the visitation. In other words, infallible Ahlul Bayt, they want to encourage people for going to the you know, visitation of Ahlul Bayt and ziyara of Ahlul Bayt alayhimu salatu wasalam. Actually, according to some narrations, we have the visitation of Imam al-Hussein and Imam al-Ridha, as I mentioned. Yeah, this encouragement does not mean that they want to undermine the importance of recommended umrah. No, it does not mean that. Rather, they want to encourage people for going to the visitation of these infallible Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salatu was-salam. Another quick reply to this question is that they want to attract the attention of people and the, you know, faithful people to the reality of Hajj and Umrah. You know that the reality of Hajj and Umrah is actually in the government, real Islamic government, which is the government of Ahlul Bayt alayhimu salatu wassalam, and the leadership and guardianship of Ahlul Bayt. For example, in one narration we have innal imama usul islam an-nami, which means that the basic fundamental of Islam and one of the most important bases of Islam is leadership and guardianship and actually imamate of Ahlul Bayt alayhimu salatu wassalam. So, by this great emphasis and encouragement for the visitation of Imam al-Hussein and different, you know, multiplied reward for that, actually, they did not want to undermine the importance and priority of Umrah. Rather, they want to encourage people for going to the visitation of Ahlul Bayt. And in the other word, we can say that they want to invite people to the, you know, real Hajj and Umrah, which is under the supervision and under the acceptance of the leadership of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salatu wassalam. I need to explain this point. First of all, we have the one of the obligations of Islam is having pilgrimage to the, you know, for this great worship of Hajj. Yes. This is very important and actually is one of the pillars of Islam, one of the great Islamic laws, that for those people who have all qualifications like financial capacity, physical capacity, yes, they have to go to and have this pilgrimage to the Mecca,
yes,
and to the house of Allah, Baytullah Al-Haram. This is one of the obligations of Islam, and it has no addition to that and no replacement to that. Nobody can say, for example, when I go to Karbala or any other place, it's replaced that. Yes. No. It is granted, established that, yes, you have to do that for mustati, for those people, yes, who are qualified. They, mm-hmm, have to go and pay visit, yes, to the house of Allah.
Yes.
It is granted.
So there is no replacement of, for example, the reward of paying visit to the holy tomb of Imam al-Hussein or going on Hajj pilgrimage.
Exactly.
It must not be in a replacement. Okay.
No, in none of the Islamic obligations, we have this permission,
yes,
to replace these Islamic obligations. تِلْكَ حُدُودُ اللَّهِ وَمَنْ يَتَعَدَّ حُدُودَ اللَّهِ فَأُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الظَّالِمُونَ.
That's right.
These are guidelines of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Nobody has right to change these laws of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
That's all right.
This is important and established idea because Islamic obligations, which we call it wajibat,
yes,
these are, we have to do that. Mm-hmm. And these are pillars of Islamic laws. But why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala sometimes gives multitudes of reward if you visit, for example, the holy shrine of Imam Hussein,
yes,
alayhi salatu wassalam.
Yes. And maybe the number here is for, we can say, showing the emphasis, isn't it?
Exactly.
Okay. It is not exactly the, for example, the quantity is 1,000 times or 1 million times.
Or, for example, 100 times.
It is not. For example, it shows the, we can say, the importance and the significance of this action.
Exactly. Okay. This is very, accurate point that you mentioned. On the other hand, we have Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because Imam al-Hussein and Imam al-Ridha alayhi wa sallam, they sacrificed whatever they had in the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. They sacrificed their life, property, and whatever belonging they have, even their soul, toward Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and the blood. They yes. sacrificed the blood and yes. whatever they had in the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. وَبَدَلَ مُهْجَتَهُ فِيكِ Okay?
Yes.
Which means that he gave whatever he had and he blood of his heart toward Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
That's all right.
So it is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wanted to compensate their sacrifice with giving multitude of reward for visitation of the holy shrine of Imam al-Ridha or Imam al-Hussein alayhi salatu wa sallam. So, okay?
Yes.
I want to say that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, out of his mercy, he wanted to give and shower the visitors of Imam al-Ridha or Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam with multitude of mercy for the respect of the dignity of these infallible Imam, Imam al-Hussein and Imam al-Ridha, for example.
Okay.
And he wanted to compensate and make up their sacrifice with giving a lot of reward for the visitors of these Imams.
That's
okay?
Right.
Or whatever. For example, visitation, or for example, reciting the Arad Ashura, or whatever related to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
That's right.
So,
and usually the quality is important because some people have, how can I say, a kind of mathematical mind in order to number the sawab that they take. Okay, for example, I had one pilgrimage to Imam al-Hussein or Imam al-Reza, so it is 1,000, for example, 1 million Hajj pilgrimage. And mathematically speaking, they are counting, for example, the rewards. This is not right, okay? Maybe you take your visit to Imam al-Hussein or Imam al-Ridha, but your visit or your ziyarah was not qualified enough.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes. Oh, for example, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will give you this kind of reward for the sake of the, you know, respecting the dignity of the and the position, high position of these infallible Imams.
That's right.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir. Inshallah,
inshallah, you'll find your way. So it does not mean that you can replace, for example, Hajj with this idea. This kind of funny.
Or for example, you leave your some of your obligations or wajibat. For example, your salat, your saum, you know, your fasting and your prayer. And then you say, okay, I go and visit an Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and then the reward of this and that will be...
No, ridiculous ideas, we cannot, you know, ascribe it to the divine religion of Islam.
That's right.
As I mentioned that, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives priority to the obligation, and it is granted.
Yes.
Nobody can say I'll replace this obligation with any other things.
That's all right.
Because these are the fundamental of Islamic laws, basis of Islamic laws.
Yes.
And without these, you do not have taqwa.
Yes. Some people might also say that, why should I go and spend, for example, my money in another land? Let's change it, for example, with spending that money, I mean, to Hajj pilgrimage or paying visit. We're helping the poor in this place and that place. This is, again, a wrong idea, isn't it?
Exactly. Because, you know, when you go to the pilgrimage, when you go to the house of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and if you have real visitation to the house of Allah, and if you become the real haji,
real haji,
in that case, you give a lot of money to the poor people. I want to say that when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives priority to some obligations, for example, paying the visit to the house of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the holding the, you know, memorial of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, if you spend a lot of money in this issue, rather the consequence of that goes to the destitute and poor people multitude times. Because those people who participate in this procession or to this visitation, they give a lot of money. for the poor people. They give a lot of charity, and the culture of giving charity and helping poor people spread all around the world. As we see in this Arba'een,
yes,
more than maybe 20 million of people, they participated more than that, you know, in the
Arba'een procession.
Arba'een
yes.
procession. So the culture of Arba'een is giving charity for poor people.
Yes.
I want to say that we should look at the priorities of Islam, and the consequence and the result of that goes to the other poor people.
That's all right. That's all right. What is the case about Imam al-Riza alayhi salam? Because Imam Hussein alayhi salam, okay, has really high status. But what about Imam al-Riza alayhi salam? Maybe the philosophy is that he is the missing link for, we can say, the Shias who believe in the Imams after Imam al-Riza too, as the eighth Imam. He is the link between all the denominations before Imam al-Riza alayhi salam and after Imam al-Riza alayhi salam, isn't it?
You know, first of all, we should look at the context, a historical context of the life and the biography of Imam al-Riza alayhi salatu wasalam. Unfortunately, in that time, some people, they deviated from the path of Imam.
Yes.
And some of them, they did not respect the position of Imam al-Ridha alayhi salatu wasalam. Okay?
That's right.
If you look at the history, you find that. And because of that, we have a lot of emphasis for visitation of Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam, and believing in the imamate of Imam al-Ridha alayhi salatu wasalam.
That's right.
And another point is that all Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, especially Imam al-Hussein and Imam al-Ridha, they sacrifice again whatever they had in the path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And again,
right.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wanted to, you know, make up their sacrifice with giving lots of reward for
That's
the visiting of the holy shrine.
That's all right. And as you said, Shaykh Nur Muhammad, so the quality here of paying visits and paying, we can say, pilgrimage is also important. There are so many people who might, for example, pay visit to Karbala or Mashhad in Iran and the house of Allah, for example, Medina and Mecca. After they get back from these holy trips to their homelands, they might not change, or there is no change in their behaviors. Or there is no, for example, reminder in the life that, for example, from now on you might be a different person because of the holy trip that you had to the other world. That's why maybe some of the behaviors and actions of such people might give the other ones the news of, for example, not going to Hajj pilgrimage or not going to pay visit, because there is no fruit for that, okay?
You know, we cannot deny that it has some effect,
at least
maybe sometimes the minimum effect, according to the receivers of people, how much they are prepared, I mean, spiritually speaking, how they are prepared themselves to receive the mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It has effect for sure on all people, but some people it has heavily affected.
Yes.
They have, on some other people it has some few effect of according to the capacities of people. So it had the, but what matters here is a culture of visitation.
That's right.
The culture of Ahlul Bayt would be spread all around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Okay.
And you know, I can say many people, they have affected by the culture of Ahlul Bayt. And, you know, actually they have some kind of feel kind of spirituality. Okay? And they feel kind of closeness toward Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And after that, generally speaking, you find that the benefit of that goes to most of the people
That's
around
right.
them. And it has very, you know, I can say, a spiritual effect on most of the people
That's
living
right.
in this universe.
That's right. Thank you much, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, for a nice elaboration regarding this question. It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Li Aliyin wa Husayn wa Hasan.
In the limelight.
The Biden administration has imposed sweeping technology restrictions on China. New rules include measures to exclude China from using semiconductor chips made anywhere in the world with U.S. tools. We look at the world media's coverage of this story. Reuters news agency has more on the story. The Biden administration on Friday, 7th of October, published a sweeping set of export controls, including a measure to cut China off from certain semiconductor chips made anywhere in the world with U.S. tools, vastly expanding its reach in its attempt to slow Beijing's technological and military advancement. The rules, some of which go into effect immediately, build on restrictions sent in letters earlier this year to top toolmakers, KLA Corp, Lam Research Corp, and Applied Materials Inc., in effect requiring them to halt shipments of equipment to wholly Chinese-owned factories producing advanced logic chips. The raft of measures could amount to the biggest shift in U.S. policy towards shipping technology to China since the 1990s. If effective, they could set China's chip manufacturing industry back years by forcing American and foreign companies that use U.S. technology to cut off support for some of China's leading factories and chip designers. In a briefing with reporters on Thursday, 6th of October, previewing the rules, senior U.S. government officials said many of the rules sought to prevent foreign firms from selling advanced chips to China or supplying Chinese firms with tools to make their own advanced chips. They conceded, however, that they had not yet secured any promises that allied nations will implement similar measures and that discussions with those nations were ongoing. We recognize that the unilateral controls we're putting into place will lose effectiveness over time if other countries don't join us, one U.S. official said. And we risk harming U.S. technology leadership if foreign competitors are not subject to similar controls. The expansion of U.S. powers to control exports to China of electronic chips made with U.S. tools is based on a broadening of the so-called Foreign Direct Product Rule. It was previously expanded to give the U.S. government authority to control exports of chips made overseas to Chinese telecommunications giant Huawei Technologies, and later to stop the flow of semiconductors to Russia. Early on Friday, the United States added China's top memory chip maker, YMTC, and 30 other Chinese firms to a list of companies that U.S. officials cannot inspect, ratcheting up tensions with Beijing and taking aim at a firm that has long troubled the Biden administration. The Washington Post has more on the same story. The Biden administration on Friday, 7th of October, announced its most aggressive measures to date aimed at limiting China's access to advanced computer chips and chip-making equipment, saying that the technology is supporting China's military modernization and even its development of weapons of mass destruction. The Biden administration said it was focusing solely on the semiconductor chips, activities and entities of greatest national security concern in China to minimize harm to the American chip industry, foundational to the U.S. economy, and disruptions to the global supply chain. The move represents a clear flexing of U.S. muscle in its competition with China, with analysts saying it amounts to a new strategy of high-tech containment of China. But officials also acknowledge the effort could backfire on the United States without buy-in from foreign partners and allies. We recognize that the unilateral controls we're putting into place tomorrow will lose effectiveness over time if other countries don't join us, and we risk harming U.S. technology leadership if foreign competitors are not subject to similar controls, said a senior Biden administration official who spoke on condition of anonymity. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan last month said the administration was seeking to shed the old approach of maintaining a relative advantage in key technologies to blowing open as large a lead as possible. The export controls imposed on Russia by the United States and 37 other countries earlier this year showed that such tools can do more than just prevent gains, Jake Sullivan said. Sullivan added, they can be a new strategic asset in the United States and allied toolkit to impose costs on adversaries and even over time degrade their battlefield capabilities. But that collective effort success only underscores the need for similar support from allies with this action, said William Reinsch, a senior U.S. Commerce Department official in the Clinton administration, but now at the Center for Strategic and International Security. William Reinsch added, this won't work unless the affected governments and companies are willing to cooperate. You're always walking a fine line between controlling too much and too little. If you control too much, then you're kneecapping your own guys, their ability to invest in new technologies. The new rules were released by the U.S. Commerce Department on Friday, 7th of October. The Semiconductor Industry Association, which represents nearly all of the U.S. semiconductor industry by revenue and almost two-thirds of non-U.S. chip firms, said in a statement it was assessing the new rules' impact and would work with members to ensure compliance. The British newspaper The Financial Times has also covered the same story. The United States has introduced sweeping export controls that will severely complicate efforts by Chinese companies to develop cutting-edge technologies with military applications in one of the toughest actions President Joe Biden has taken against China. The U.S. Commerce Department on Friday, 7th of October, announced restrictions that will make it extremely hard for Chinese companies to obtain or manufacture advanced computer chips and will slow their progress in artificial intelligence. The measures are also designed to make it much tougher for China to develop supercomputers with military applications. The controls mark a new attempt to decouple China from the United States in the cutting-edge technologies. They come days before Chinese President Xi Jinping is expected to seal a third term as leader of China at the 20th National Congress of China. Paul Triolo, a China and technology expert at Albright Stonebridge, a consultancy firm, said the action was a major watershed in U.S.-China relations and in the increasingly intense technology competition between Washington and Beijing. The U.S. has essentially declared war on China's ability to advance the country's use of high-performance computing for economic and security gains, said Paul Triolo. The controls will hit Chinese companies in multiple ways. They will bar U.S. companies from exporting critical chip manufacturing tools to China, which will affect groups such as Semiconductor Manufacturing International Corp, Yangtze Memory Technologies Corp, and Changxin Memory.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
الرحمن الرحيم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Virtues of the Believers, Friday the 3rd of Ramadan, 1394, the 20th of September, 1974. Another example of anfal is mineral wealth, ma'adin, that is extracted from beneath the ground. Yet another example is the forests, the deserts, or the great pastures in valleys or on mountains. In short, anfal denotes any kind of wealth that does not belong to a single person or to a single group of people, but rather is public property, belonging to the nation as a collective. However, one of the aforementioned examples are those spoils won by soldiers in warfare. The first time this question seems to have been raised was after the Battle of Badr, when the Muslims were discussing how they should divide the spoils they had won. They disagreed with one another, so they referred the matter to the Prophet and asked him what they should do. Their answer came in the form of the aforementioned verse of the Quran. Say, the anfal belong to Allah and the Apostle. What does it mean when the Quran says they belong to Allah? Means that they do not belong to any one particular group of people. Anything that belongs to Allah, anything that is said to be God's property, actually means something that should be used for godly aims.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Clearly, when we say that something belongs to God, we do not mean that it should be spent for God's benefit, because God does not benefit from wealth. God does not have any needs. God does not have any wants. So there is no need to spend His wealth to fulfill these. On the contrary, when we speak of God's property, we mean the property of all of His servants. Therefore, His wealth should be used for those causes alone which God has specified. This is the meaning of saying something belongs to Allah. And the Apostle, what does this mean? That it is the property of the Messenger. Yes, but what does that mean? Is the Prophet the polar opposite of God? Of course not. But when we say something belongs to Allah, someone might come along and give himself the right to do with it as he pleases, because it belongs to no one in particular. He can say, this belongs to Allah, and we are all Allah's servants. So using this pleasant-sounding and attractive slogan, the person can use something that belongs to everyone for his own personal benefit. Therefore, while Allah's wealth is supposed to be used for the benefit of all the Muslims and all of God's true servants, using it for the public good does not mean it can be used haphazardly, as anyone pleases. On the contrary, there should be some management of this wealth. There should be someone in charge of it as God's representative, who will look after people's interests.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. guiding me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The second Caspian Economic Forum has been held in Moscow. During the event, issues including developing trade and economic cooperation, interaction in the field of ecology, energy, transport and logistics were discussed. Delegations from the Caspian five littoral states, namely Russia, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Iran and Azerbaijan, were present at the event.
The countries of the Caspian region will have to work in the current turbulent conditions of the global economy and geostrategic tensions. The West is putting increasing pressure on other countries in an attempt to maintain the existing world order.
The Caspian region possesses a significant part of the world's gas and oil reserves. It is of high significance, especially at a time when the whole world is facing an unprecedented energy crisis. The Iranian authorities came up with a new proposal to address those issues.
In order to unify and harmonize tariffs for rail, road and sea transportation, expanding trade and economic cooperation, we propose to establish a committee for cooperation in the field of transport, transit and customs business.
The Islamic Republic, given its geographical location, has very good opportunities to conduct operations in the oil and gas sector, as well as providing energy supplies to other regions. Iran has stressed the need to accelerate the unification of the country's electric power networks with those of the Caspian states.
The main purpose of this forum is boosting the economy of regional countries and to enable the Caspian states to use their opportunities to develop trade and economic cooperation, culture and tourism. Also, everyone should not only use the opportunities of the Caspian Sea, but also protect it. We are actively working in the development of the North-South Transport Corridor. The shipping lines of the Islamic Republic of Iran have allocated 300 containers for the transportation of goods to Russia.
Apart from what was said and proposed at the event, the forum also had good news for the member states. Cruise shipping on the Caspian Sea is set to begin in 2023 for the first time in history.
More than 1,000 delegates from the five Caspian Sea littoral states, as well as Belarus, Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan, have taken part in the forum. In the meeting, the participants agreed to adopt decisions to enhance all-out cooperation among countries in the Caspian region. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
The battered village of Golmovsky. The front line is only 100 meters away. There is a deadly tension here as the streets are almost deserted.
And there are a few people on the streets here picking up humanitarian supplies. I've tried to speak to some of them, but they just shake their head and say, I'd like to speak to you, but we just need to rush home because it's too dangerous here. There's shelling at any moment. They can be hit.
In some relative shelter, this man would speak to me.
Are you concerned about Ukrainian advances to the north of here?
No, I don't think they will come here. Everyone will rise up and won't let them. The people here have nowhere else to go. They couldn't beat us when there were only a few of us, and now Russia supports us.
And what do you think of the Ukrainians and the Ukrainian military?
They are not human. They know perfectly well where they shell. The square here is full of craters. Women were killed just over there while working. They know what they target.
It is mostly the elderly who remain in this town. They have nowhere else to go and so are stranded in the middle of an artillery duel between the opposing armies. The boom of outgoing fire, a pro-Russian artillery piece, can't be far from the village. This man tells me he's 76 years old. He fears the coming winter as his windows have been smashed by a blast. He also blames the Ukrainians for the war and says they were sent here by the Americans and the Europeans. We head to the neighboring village of Zaitsevo. It was fully taken by pro-Russian forces a couple of weeks ago.
The front lines are a couple of 100 meters away from here. It's understandably a ghost town at the moment. Very few civilians are here. Now, Barmut, a major settlement, isn't too far to the north of here. The Russians, or the pro-Russians, have been trying to take that settlement for months now. And just further to the north of that is Lyman, where the Ukrainian army has had some major successes in the last few days.
The situation is unstable. As you know, Zaitsevo is finally completely liberated. All its parts are now under our control. I think being here today, you'll hear that it's quite loud at the front lines. Artillery, both ours and the enemy's, are working. It's still early to relax.
Are you concerned about the Ukrainian advances to the north?
The north of our republic is a bit far from us. In our direction, it's only our forces that are moving forward. What's going on there decides nothing for us.
Amongst the deadly tension of this village, the incongruous site of a rose garden, it houses a monument to civilians killed by Ukrainian shelling. It was built 18 months before the Russians sent their army across the border in February. A reminder that Ukraine has been bombing pro-Russian areas here for 8 years.
I lived and worked here in the village and saw what's going on. I can tell you there is nobody here, including me, who would agree to any compromise. We have suffered so much during this time that hardly anything can make peace between us.
With peace talks unlikely anytime soon, frontline positions are fluctuating across hundreds of kilometers of Ukraine. Both sides will want to gain as much territory as possible before the winter comes, making advances more difficult. Jenny Miller, Donbass.
New jobs data in the United States showed a collapse of 1.1 million job openings, the biggest one-month crash ever outside of the COVID lockdown. It's also the first increase in the unemployment rate since April 2020, and that has many so-called recession deniers being forced to reconsider. The United States has had two consecutive quarters of negative economic growth, which is the standard definition of economic recession. However, in an effort to avoid the negative press the recession label receives, the administration of President Joe Biden claimed that a stable unemployment rate meant that the U.S. was not in a recession. That's no longer possible. Due to the so-called Uberization of the United States economy, the official data has long been accused of falsely portraying a rosy picture. The national unemployment rate is 4%, but many say the jobs available are part-time or lack crucial benefits like health care or are poorly paid despite the current record inflation.
People looking for benefits, they want to work from home. People are not settling like they used to. It's just a matter of, I don't want to say laziness, but I think people are just, they're trying to get the best that they want, and companies are trying to hold steady and their wages, and they're not willing to pay as much because costs are going up for them as well.
Amid the backfiring of Western sanctions on Russia, many businesses have responded by cutting job listings, slowing the hiring process, and may begin mass layoffs.
Now we've got the threat of recession, so some employers are cutting back on their hiring. My son-in-law just had to